The Capital Investment Committee hearing for February 19th is called to order. Members, we do not have quorum, and so we're just going to move forward to the presentation. So last week, we had a broad overview from the Commissioner of MMB with regards to the Governor's 2024 bonding recommendations. Today, we will have the two-state system, first the University of Minnesota, then Minnesota State, coming to talk about their 2024 request and HEPR funds, and then after that we will have MMB come on board to talk about some of the federal infrastructure dollars. With us today, welcome Vice President Robert Davis. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Lee and members. Thank you for the invitation to be here today. For the record, I am Alice Roberts Davis. I am the Vice President for University Services at the University of Minnesota. This time last year, I would have been testifying in front of you in a different capacity as Commissioner of Administration, but this year I'm with the university still doing work to contribute to the great state of Minnesota. I am very pleased to have also with us here today two of our regents for the university, Regent Farnsworth and Regent Turner. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about the partnership between the state and the university. Since HEPR was first enacted by the state in 1994, the university has made it a top priority of our requests. This year, it is our only priority. Our request is for $500 million, similar to our colleagues at Minnesota State, and Interim President Ettinger and their chancellor have been working closely together all over the state to talk about why this is such a high priority for both of our. This is a different approach than we've had in the past because our circumstances are so dire that our message is that if you will help us with this, we will not ask for anything else. Additionally, we've heard from the legislature anecdotally over the years that we shouldn't be building more buildings, but we should be taking care of what we already have. And so our message to you is that we've heard you and we are responding by asking only for HEPR dollars. We won't build any net new square footage. We will work on implementing the HEPR dollars that are funded, and we will consolidate the space that we already have and also shed or demolish any obsolete space. When we look at our existing facilities, we use a systematic approach to assess and grade the condition of our facilities, much like the state does. What's particularly concerning for us is that we now have nearly $6 billion in need, and more than 30% of our space is rated poor or critical. You should really look at this and read the red and yellow pieces of the donuts together, because properties that are in fair or below average condition can fall into poor and critical condition very rapidly without a timely investment. For the university, state bond funding has been less predictable than ever. There is very little ability for us to forecast either how much funding the university will receive, when it will receive funding, and even if it will receive funding. That unpredictability makes it very difficult for us to create accurate and meaningful capital plans and to align the development of our individual reinvestment projects over the availability of state funding. Over the last decade, the university has only received about 10% of the funding that we've requested, and in half of those past 10 years, we've received $0 for HEPR. Buildings that are already in disrepair have slid deeper into disrepair. Now, each of us knows that if you own a home that's 50, 60, or 70 years old, or older, and that's what some of our buildings are, you can expect to make major replacements and repairs to plumbing or wiring or doors and windows and roofs, but we want to do that so that we don't have catastrophic failures in our buildings, and we're in the same situation at the university. An emergency repair is far more expensive than a planned upgrade. Working with our facility assessment and benchmarking partners, we're able to estimate how much should be invested each year. The yellow range on this graph represents facility renewal targets. the bottom line indicating the minimum amount of funding necessary to hold ground on facility upkeep, and the upper line indicating the target to actually make progress on reducing our $5.9 billion facility renewal need. You'll also note that the university makes significant contributions to this as well. An estimated $700 million has been added to the backlog over the last 10-year period. In the years where we do receive state support, we're typically able to meet our renewal targets. So although figures and graphs are helpful for context, it's equally, if not more, important to talk about the outcomes of your support of our 2024 request and what that will have. I'd like to lead with safety and accessibility because these things are so fundamental to operating a campus that is safe and welcoming for all students, staff, faculty, and visitors. Your full support of our $500 million request would invest over $100 million across more than 60 safety, code, and accessibility projects on all of our campuses. Projects like the Washington Avenue Pedestrian Bridge, where we desperately need to replace the crumbling structure and provide a safer railing option, is a critical priority. We need to update the Multi-Ethnic Resource Center in Morris, which lacks an elevator or accessible restrooms, and the visitor cabin in Itasca, where we need to add an entrance ramp, which will allow equal access for visitors with limited mobility. Reliability comes next on our list of priorities because we can't expect to maintain our status as a top research and teaching university when we can't rely on our buildings. It's a fact that planned repairs are less costly and less disruptive. When we are unable to keep up, we have emergencies like power outages and building leaks that can displace a class or researcher for hours or even days. And that did happen in Duluth over the summer because of heat. And you can imagine the angst of a researcher who's been working on a project for days, months, or years who may be concerned about losing research because of a building failure. Emergencies also tend to create cascading problems when a roof leaks and when water gets inside, where all of a sudden there's a host of problems from mold to potential contact with critical mechanical or electrical systems. Your support will help us tackle repairs like replacing natural gas lines in Crookston, fixing the roof at McNeil Hall on the St. Paul campus, and completely overhauling the mechanical equipment in the Food Science Nutrition Building that supports their labs and food pilot plant. Finally, your support will protect and extend the investments that the state has made in the past. More than half of the used buildings are over 50 years old, and many are far older than that. In fact, our oldest building, Eddie Hall, is almost 140 years old. We had an opportunity to tour many of you through Eddie Hall this fall and some of our other historic buildings. And if you did not get a chance to take that tour, we would love to give you that tour at some point. But we hope that you could appreciate how special these buildings are to our campus and to the state, and also how critical it is for us to keep up with the reinvestment so that they can remain safe and functional for years to come. Your support would help us renew Eddie Hall into a new student services hub, as well as restore the exterior facade at Pattee and waterproof the foundation, which would allow us to turn this into a new American Indian Studies facility. The photos at the top are from the 1914 portion of McNeil Hall in St. Paul, where we waited too long, and that led to a near miss when a large chunk of masonry peeled off from the ceiling and landed on a conference room table. And fortunately, no one was there when that happened. We know that HEPA is cheaper. It's more cost effective to extend the life of an existing building than to build a new one. And it's also much more less expensive and disruptive to do planned repairs and replacement than to address an emergency failure. HEPA investments allow us to fix the core infrastructure problems that come along with every aging building, which in turn allows colleges to invest in their programmatic needs and make the university a preeminent teaching and researching institution. I'd like to give you a real example to further illustrate the point. This is the 1948 Mechanical Engineering Building that was severely outdated for modern teaching and learning. The poor condition of the facility, especially the labs, was negatively affecting student experience and impacting the quality of education. Faculty could not pursue certain areas of research due to code issues in their laboratories, and more than one improvised solution had been put in place by the resourceful engineer that we had working in the building. We had a choice to either renovate or replace. So along with some university funding, we also invested a total of $47 million in HEPR over three phases, with construction concluding in 2020. We estimate that a new building would have cost more than $100 million, not including demolition, utility, and so forth. So additionally, it would have required a total occupant displacement and disruption to programming, which was mostly avoided through the phased HEPR approach. The core HEPR investments allowed the university to then reinvest back into the labs with modern program enhancements to restore the usability and competitiveness of these two programs. HEPR funds are allocated to every campus, as well as research and outreach centers located throughout the state. As a starting point, we use a straightforward formula to determine allocation to use at each campus based on size and condition. Supplemental HEPR is provided to the system campuses on occasion to help advance larger projects. Over the last 5 years, the actual allocation to system campuses has been notably larger than the model would prescribe. As the governor's proposed $103 million, we would support the number one request for each of the system campuses. For Crookston, that would be the heating plant, which needs critical improvements for reliability. In Duluth, Heller Hall needs comprehensive HVAC and code renewal. Morris needs multi-ethnic resource centers, major improvements to code and life safety. At the Twin Cities, we would improve the Washington Avenue pedestrian bridge and replace the deteriorated pedestrian enclosure and safety railings. And finally, on the St. Paul campus, we would improve the food science and nutrition building because it needs comprehensive code, life safety, and HVAC renewal. So for many of us, we think of investment in HEPR as investment in buildings, but it really is an investment in our future workforce. As a state, we've done an outstanding job investing in our K-12 education, and a lot of students who are coming out of their high schools are looking at the university's facilities as an actual step backward because of the age and dated laboratories and facilities that we have, and they start to look at other competitive universities. When that happens and they go to other states or other universities outside of the state, they build relationships both personally and professionally, and they don't return to the state. For us, this is really about a workforce issue. We see that far more students leave the state than come to the state for education, and so if we want to ensure that we're competitive and have a long-term workforce in the state, we really do have to provide assets that are attractive to our top talented students. When we receive state funding, we put it to good use, and we are poised to do the same thing in 2024. As we reported in January, 94% of the 2023 appropriation has already been allocated to critical renewal projects. It's clear that capital investment is good for the local economy too, because more than 90% of our expenditures go back to vendors in Minnesota. I'd like to close by saying thank you for your past partnership and assuring you that we have more than enough shovel-ready projects for 2024, and we would just ask that you fully fund our request of $500 million so that we can attack the projects that are so important to the campuses of the University of Minnesota and our students, faculty, and staff.
Thank you. And then it's my understanding that there's two other presenters.
We do have other presenters. Okay. Would you like to move directly into those, Chair Lee?
We'll have them come down, and then after that, we'll take members' questions.
Okay,
so next up, we have Dr. Hill Gallant.
Thank you.
And then if Mr. Andrew Larson can just come down too. Welcome, Professor. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good Chair Lee and members of the committee, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me today. My name is Kathleen Hill-Gallant, and I am an associate professor of nutrition in the Department of Food Science and Nutrition at the University of Minnesota, and I am a resident of Maple Grove. I work in the Food Science and Nutrition building that was just highlighted, which is located on the St. Paul campus. There, I teach both undergraduate and graduate students, and I conduct research related to nutrition in various chronic disease states. So our building is one with critical needs for infrastructure improvements that are included in this HEPA request, and these are very long overdue. They're affecting the safety, the learning environment, research productivity, as well as our ability to secure external research funding to bring into the university, and ultimately our ability to fulfill our land grant mission on research, teaching, and service to the state of Minnesota. I came to the U in 2020 from another Big Ten land grant peer institution, and I came here for the excellent reputation of the University of Minnesota, as well as to be closer to my family living here in Minnesota. However, I quickly experienced challenges related to the condition of our building. So a key example is that when I purchased a critical instrument necessary for my research, which really had very simple electrical and ventilation needs, it ended up costing a construction project to retrofit the building that cost more than the instrument itself. And this was due to that aged infrastructure, which included the need for asbestos abatement. So the aging infrastructure of our building really impedes and makes more costly our ability to conduct and fund research. I am also currently awaiting a significant grant of several million dollars from the National Institutes of Health to conduct two clinical trials in nutrition in cardiovascular health related to chronic kidney disease. But the success of that project and the ability to continue to achieve funding like that relies on having adequate facilities. Our department is a hub for food science and nutrition in the state. And through our mission, we help the vast Minnesota ag and food industries, farmers, as well as the health and nutrition of Minnesotans. Our community nutrition research and outreach reaches to various communities, including partnerships in urban, rural, and tribal communities across the state. And notably, I'm a registered dietitian. My teaching involves teaching future registered dietitians, both in the undergraduate and graduate programs. And approximately 75% of the dietitians who practice in the state of Minnesota receive their education and their training through our department. Dietitians, if you're not familiar with their role, they have a critical role in chronic disease prevention, and they provide nutrition care within the healthcare system for people who are dealing with chronic diseases and other medical conditions. So continuing being able to train these health professionals is very important. So in closing, I urge you to fully support this HEPA request so that we can continue to fulfill our mission.
Thank you. Mr. Larson, please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee and members of the committee, thank you all for allowing me to speak this afternoon. My name is Andrew Larson, and I'm a third-year student at the University of Minnesota studying computer science, and am additionally the speaker forum at the undergraduate student government. I'm originally from Bloomington, Minnesota, and decided to attend the university over other options for a number of reasons, including its statewide impact. Today, I'm speaking in support of the university's 2024 capital renewal request to reinvest in existing campus buildings and infrastructure. These projects will increase student safety and accessibility and improve student learning and success. I'd like to take a couple of minutes to go over a few items included in the request and their importance for students at the university. First of these is the Washington Avenue pedestrian bridge on the Twin Cities campus. The bridge is used by thousands of students each day and has for some time been in need of further investment, particularly investments to improvements that will contribute to pedestrian and student safety, an initiative that has been a community priority for some time. Another item of importance to students is campus accessibility. One half of the University of Minnesota buildings are 50 years of age or older, and state funding is needed to upgrade aging elevators and non-ADA compliant restrooms. Inaccessible buildings on campus lead to missed learning opportunities and place a burden on students and detract from their ability to thrive academically, compromising the university's ability to deliver world-class education to all of its students. I believe an investment in the University of Minnesota is an investment in our state's future workforce and communities. The projects in the request before you ensure that students can thrive academically and professionally, and that the university can remain a leader in higher education. Chair Lee and members of the committee, thank you again for providing me this opportunity to speak today.
Thank you both for your testimony. Can we get Vice President Roberts Davis back to the lectern?
Are we staying?
You two can go, and if we have questions for you, we'll have you come back up. Thank you both. First up, we have Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. You all settled in now?
I am. Thank you.
All right. So you'd like $500 million, but your request is $103 million. Now, how much does the U contribute to the HEPR projects?
Shirley, Representative Erdahl, the request is $500 million. The governor's recommendation is $100 million. HEPR is a formulaic process, so it depends on the project. If we were doing a renovation of a building, HEPR would cover some of the repairs and replacement aspects of the project. The university would cover other aspects of the project, and so it's difficult for me to say how much money exactly would come from the university, but it's a one-third, two-thirds comparison for when we're doing new construction versus repair replacement.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously the difficulty we have here is that asset preservation needs across the whole state of Minnesota are gigantic.
Absolutely.
And one of the failures, I think, of the legislative process over the many years has been the failure to keep up with the property that the state of Minnesota owns.
Agreed.
And I'm guessing that we'll do the best we can to try to keep you from falling too much more behind. But, I mean, very simply, looking at the figures, between you and Minnesota State, of what we can do, the ceiling is $830 million, so you're looking at almost a fourth of that for our education systems. So it's going to come down to what can we do with our, and certainly yours and Minnesota State's requests are I think, very legitimate and very needed. It just will be coming down to what can we do when we look at the DNR and our water projects and all of these other things that are also going to be on our table. So, appreciate that you have the commitment and the desire. We'll just have to take a look at how we can prioritize what we can get done. But I assure you that the university and our state colleges remain one of my priorities.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank the university for giving us a breakdown by campus. And I'm going to repeat a couple of things that you said just for clarity. But for instance, if we look at Crookston and Duluth, these are in rank order of priority. So the first in Crookston is the heating plant, and the first in Duluth is Heller Hall. That's correct, right?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
So the order of priority that you gave us is by campus, and the number one priority is listed at the top for each campus.
Chair Lee, Representative Pulaski, I'm just double checking that that is true, and I believe that that is almost accurate with that exception, except for the Twin Cities campus. On the Twin Cities campus, our top priorities would be the bridge, the Washington Avenue pedestrian bridge, which is number 55. Food science nutrition is accurate, number 47 at the top. Yes.
Representative Pulaski.
So, Mr. Chair and Vice President Roberts Davis, we may have an interesting method here of coming to a number. If we came up with a Heber number, we would be doing it by perhaps adding up their number one priorities, and then we would be sure that the number one priorities would be taken care of. And I'm not asking the chair that as much as I'm asking Vice President Robert Davis. Would that be correct? So if we came up with a rather odd number instead of an even number, it would be taking these priorities and saying, all right, we're going to add those up, and that's what we're going to give you, and we're going to be sure that those are taken care of.
Vice President Robert Davis.
Chair Lee, Representative Pulaski, if you take those numbers of those top priorities, you will come to roughly $103 million, which is the governor's recommendation. And so we're trying to back into that number. We would have a little bit of money left over to do some miscellaneous building envelope projects, windows, roofs, things like that. But you generally come to about $103 million. We would really like to see some additional projects that are going to be taken care of, because although these are our top priorities, there are many that are also critical life safety projects that need to be taken care of as well.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair and Vice President Roberts Davis, I'm not suggesting we even get to 100. I'm not sure what the number is going to be. But I want to focus in on one, on the heating plant for Crookston. And the paragraph that you have on your handout, where this was built in 1911, the campus must have been dramatically different then. And then you state there were major improvements made to improve the reliability of this in recent years. Can you tell me what those improvements were and how much in recent years?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, Representative Pulaski, I cannot tell you specifically what those improvements would have been in recent years. I'd be happy to get that information for you. But what I can tell you is that the heating plant has been extremely unreliable. And with Crookston being our coldest weather location and having suffered bouts with having no heat on the campus for students, it is critical that we make an investment in that heating plant.
Representative Pulaski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Vice President Robert Davis, I'm very familiar with heating plants in cold climates. Does this heating plant also pump water, for instance, out of any basements of these buildings that would be critical when we get to January, February, March? And if this heating plant breaks down, it no longer pumps that water out of the basements of those buildings?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, Representative Pulaski, I don't believe that it does. I'll ask for help from a friend.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed to Representative Pulaski's questions.
So my name is Brian Swanson. I'm Assistant Vice President with University Services. If I can go back one question about the recent upgrades in the heating plant, those were not necessarily made to the heating plant itself. The reference was to the electrical infrastructure that feeds the heating plant. So we've worked a lot on the Crookston campus electrical infrastructure, and you might recall from a few years ago, we had a massive power outage that took out the electricity to the shared Crookston, the football stadium that the Crookston High School uses with the campus. So the we made a fairly substantial investment in electrical infrastructure. But the heating plant itself, I don't think, has had any major investments in it since maybe the 80s.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, the 1980s? Is that what you just said?
So the portions of it, I believe.
So you should have a paragraph in here about recent upgrades were done decades ago. But I'm going to continue with another. Mr. Chair, and now that we've got everybody here, does this also cool the campus as well as heat it?
Mr. Swanson.
Representative Pulaski, the Crookston heating plant, I believe, is just a heating plant and not a central cooling plant.
All right. Then
Representative Pulaski.
Got one last question. Does the university ever seek out alumni support for fixing these things? I know that you get a lot of support for new buildings, but perhaps wouldn't there be an alumni that would want to put $6 million in here and have their name affixed to the heating plant and saving it?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, Representative Pulaski, we do ask for philanthropic support for a lot of projects that we work on, but we are not pursuing philanthropic support for the Crookston facility specifically at this point in time.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, then I would suggest to the university it might want to do that.
Thank you.
You don't need to respond.
Thank you, Representative Pawlowski. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, when we did the last stop, I asked a question about how do we deal with this potential, not potential, but the actual demographic cliff that's coming with the birth rate peaking in 2007. And we saw that at the Humphrey Institute with our session last week. So when we have, you know, looking at this substantial list of repair, how do we deal with that? I mean, are we talking about closing some things? Are we, if there aren't students, what do we do?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Surely, Representative, I'm not aware of the conversations about campus closures. I'm not sure that's something that we would discuss at this point in time, but I know that you are correct. There are some shifts in demographics, and you know, there's a chicken and an egg philosophy as well, which is if the campus facilities are not appealing, is that the reason why students are choosing different campuses, different states, to go and pursue their degrees? And you know, to the assistant professor's testimony, there are at least three other campuses that are in close proximity to ours that have new food science nutrition facilities, and we're seeing that they are actually attracting quite a few students. It's that type of thing that we have to be competitive about, and we want to make sure that we are in a position to attract top talent here. So,
Representative Hansen. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just kind of piggybacking off of what Representative Hansen had to say, so there's 600 students that are currently attending on campus at the University of Crookston, 900 online. The $10 million ask equates to about, just for the students that are on campus, those are the 600, would be $16,670. You know, I think this body does need to look out for the taxpayers of Minnesota and decide if, you know, this is just this year's ask. Was $10 million, but as stewards of tax dollars, we have to decide if continuing to put money into a university that is not attracting students, maybe we got to think about consolidating schools.
Vice President Roberts Davis, any comments?
Thank you, Chair Lee. It is a $6 million investment. At this point in time, and it's something that is helpful to the university. It is something that we need in order to ensure that the students who are on the campus are safe and that they have a reliable heating system on the campus. And so it is very important that we make sure that we implement this change.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct. The $6 million is for heating, but it's a $10 million ask total.
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, yes, Representative, if we were to do all the things on the Crookston campus list, however, we don't have, this would be, just the heating plant would be far in excess of what their proportion of any sort of allocation would be. So that would not be the plan.
Good, Representative Friends. So before we move on to Minnesota State, just real quickly, if you could follow up, I know that you know your request here is for $500 million. If you could just send us a list of your priority, if it's at 103, like you mentioned, it might just be all the top priorities, but I think it will be good for us to have that sheet. And then the last question that I have, just on this page right here, you said that 94% of the 2023 appropriations have been spent, encumbered, or otherwise obligated. Can you tell us, of the amount that's been spent in encumber, what is that amount? Is that the total amount that was appropriated in 2023?
I'm sorry, Chair Lee, the dollar amount that's been spent?
That's been spent or encumbered. Of the $43.35 million that was appropriated in 2023, can you tell us how much of that has been spent or encumbered? Mrs. Swanson.
Chair Lee, the report that we sent at the end of January, the amount that was spent or encumbered under contract was 36%, but the obligated then would be anything that you can't not finish the project. So with the things that are under contract or encumbered come the obligated responsibilities. So that where we are in the status of the project, the higher number is a more accurate reflection of the progress we've made on the projects to date.
And so can you tell us what is the timeline of those that has been obligated from 36 to 94? I think that's a big jump. And so of the those that are obligated, are they ready to go and be completed this year, or are you still looking into the future to complete those projects?
Chair Lee, most of those, if I'm just looking at the report that we sent in January, would be projects that are in design right now. So we may have procured the architect, and we have an estimate for what that construction cost would be. We have not yet entered into the construction contract, but as soon as the design is done, we'll be ready to move into construction. Okay.
Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Vice President, and also Dr. Hill-Gallant and Mr. Larson. I always appreciate hearing from a student, so thank you for being here. My question is about the Governor's Task Force on Academic Health at the University of Minnesota. There are a number of references to capital investment, to bonding, to infrastructure, and I'm just curious how these would layer together. If that was considered as you looked at your priorities, if they considered your priorities when they were working on this, and what happens if a priority from the academic health report were to come up to the top, how would that affect the rest of your HEPA requests?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, Representative, the recommendations from the task force report are completely independent from our HEPA list.
Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Chair Lee. So if there were major funds needed for this, would it then come back and affect your HEPA? What would you anticipate?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, we would expect that those would remain independent and that they would not be a part of our HEPA list. The HEPA list would be for our campus projects that we were hoping to reinvest in. The academic health would be a separate request.
Thank you both for being here to present the University of Minnesota's presentation.
Thank you for the opportunity, Chair members.
Next on the agenda, we have Minnesota State with Chancellor Olson and Associate Vice Chancellor Yolitz. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee, members of the committee, happy President's Day. My name is Scott Olson. I serve Minnesota as the Chancellor of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Today with my colleague Brian Yolitz, we'll be providing an overview of the request that's been approved by our Board of Trustees for your consideration. We're pleased to be joined today by the Chair of our Board of Trustees, Roger Moe, is waving there, and by the President of St. Paul College, Dee Dee Peasley. I want to begin with a sincere thank you. Thank you for the committee's support during the last legislative session. You invested over $180 million in Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and their infrastructure. Of that amount, $44 million in HEPA funding supported 20 campuses to stay safe, warm, and dry and build the workforce that Minnesota needs tomorrow. So while I'm new in this role as Minnesota State Chancellor, I'm not new to this system or to this process. From my time at Winona State University, I worked with Representative Pawlowski to establish the Education Village, and Representative Erdahl might even remember Trafton Hall at MSU Mankato, which we worked on when I was there and which sadly still has a flat roof. So I can attest to you that your investments can be transformational for students, faculty, and staff, and I look forward to the work that lies ahead for us. Speaking of Winona, I want to note that Representative Pawlowski serves on this committee, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank him for his mentorship, for his wisdom about higher education, and for everything he's done for Winona and for Minnesota. During my first month on the job, I visited all of the campuses in the Minnesota State College and University system that had a project. And I learned firsthand that the infrastructure needs of our campuses are real, and they impact our ability to recruit and retain students and faculty, those students who will become Minnesota's future workforce. So our story is very similar to the story that you just heard from the University of Minnesota, and I was pleased to spend time a couple of weeks ago with Interim President Ettinger, touring the state, talking to different communities about the commonality of the needs for asset preservation at the University of Minnesota and at Minnesota State. Prioritizing an investment in Minnesota State public higher education, both at the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State, is an investment in Minnesota's future. A big thanks to the committee and the staff for traveling around Minnesota to see these projects. When I talk to colleagues from other states, they're amazed that you travel and you go and you see all these projects in all the communities. That's a really unique and rare and special thing that we do here in Minnesota. Thank you also to the campus leaders, the students, faculty, and staff who helped make these tours run so well. We were pleased to host both the House and Senate Capital Investment Committees at 40 of our campuses this fall. As you saw, your colleges and universities have pressing needs, and we are committed first and foremost in taking care of what we have. That's why our board's number one request is $200 million for HEPR. HEPR's critical. Regarding the age of our infrastructure, Minnesota State, 40% of the buildings on our campus and 60% of the square footage on our campuses are 50 years old or more. All of the projects in our request have completed the pre-design and are ready for design and construction. As you know, many jobs will be created because of your investment, so Minnesota State campuses are located throughout Minnesota, so these jobs are everywhere. Before I turn the presentation over to Mr. Yolitz, I'd like to recognize and thank you for honoring the Board of Trustees' priority ordering in the past. As you know, we go through a very rigorous process of ordering these requests that involves representatives from all of our campuses reading, scoring, ranking these things, and then our board approves one master list. So, Chair Lee, with your permission, I'd like to turn over the presentation to our Associate Vice Chancellor, Brian Yolitz.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Lee and committee. I am Brian Yolitz, and I serve as Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities for the Minnesota State System of Colleges and Universities. It's good to be with you again. We're not on the road, and Steve isn't driving the bus, but it's good to be with you nonetheless. During this bonding session, Minnesota State seeks a capital investment funding for $541.4 million program to preserve, protect, and improve existing college-university facilities to better serve and educate Minnesotans and our workforce. $200 million of the request is for asset preservation through HEPR to fund more than 70 projects at our college university campuses across the state. The balance is $341.4 million is for the design and or construction of work at 15 specific college university projects depicted in the green stars on the map of Minnesota. These include construction of 5 projects that the state invested in design work in the last session, totaling about $17.3 million, design and construction of 8 projects, and then the design of 2 campus projects that would seek construction funding in a future legislative session. As Chancellor Olson noted earlier, all of these projects have completed their pre-design work and are ready to move forward now. Given our one-third debt shared responsibility for individual college or university projects, this program seeks total state funding of $427.6 million and user financing of $113.8 million for the 15 project requests. And this user financing is funded by Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. This program request and priorities are the result of a disciplined process that Chancellor Olson provided an overview on and begins really with our ongoing campus facilities planning. It's a documented process of over a 5-year cycle where individual college universities develop comprehensive facilities plans, or CFPs, that look at a host of issues in terms of academic programming, facility conditions, as well as demographic trends in their region. In preparation for this legislative session, our Board of Trustees adopted guidelines for developing their request and priorities in April of 2022. The guidelines embraced four major themes focused on adapting and modernizing academic and support spaces, critical to student success, facilitating the fulfillment of our vision for Equity 2030, advancing resilience and environmental sustainability, and no net increase in our academic square footage. The institutions reviewed their CFPs and developed pre-designs for their individual candidate projects. These candidate projects were scored by representatives from across the system against our board guidelines. The results were then offered to our chancellor and then to our board of trustees, who reviewed and approved the request in June of 2023. The program has been uploaded in the capital budget system managed by MMB. And this committee, along with your colleagues from the Senate, MMB, and the governor's office, have made over 40 visits to our during bonding tours, as Chancellor Olson noted, since last August, or about the last 6 months or so. And we've been very, very busy sharing our projects. While there's a great deal of project documentation in the capital budget system, we found that the bonding book is a better tool to kind of guide discussions and understanding of our project requests for your review. We understand the committees had been shared either a link or the bonding book, and hard copies, I believe, are available also for handouts should others be interested. We use that as a reference for the pages to guide you through a review of our program request. You'll see on page 7 of the bonding book, after some introductory information orienting readers to the Minnesota state system and our student and the students we serve, is our full request in priority order. The number one priority is for $200 million for higher education asset preservation and replacement, or HEPR funding. This funds preservation projects, including roof replacements and mechanical and utility system upgrades at every Minnesota State College and University, saving energy, making campuses safer, and reducing operating expenses. The HEPR funding for asset preservation of existing campus academic buildings continues to be an urgent need, and you heard that story at each and every one of your stops during the past fall. And you've heard the same thing from, and you will hear the same thing from many other state entities as we look at our aging infrastructure. For more detail on this and campus impacts, you can see some details on pages 8 through 11 of the bonding book. Taking a look at HEPR funding history, we see that in the last six bonding years, 2012, 14, 16, 18, 20, and 22, Minnesota State has requested $760 million for asset preservation of existing buildings through HEPR as our number one priority for college universities. These requests were to address the most urgent college and university needs, exterior repairs including roofs, windows, doors, exterior brickwork and tuck pointing, heating and cooling system upgrades, and upgrades to utility and energy management systems. In all of the bonding bills passed between 2012 and 2023, Minnesota State has received $223.5 million in HEPR funding, or less than 30% of our requested amount needed to address the most urgent preservation needs of our campus buildings. This level of HEPR funding has led to major preservation needs going unmet or deferred. And as a result, we've seen the backlog of maintenance in our academic buildings, meaning the estimated costs of the building components and systems that have exceeded their useful lives and are now outdated or obsolete grow. Since 2013, we've seen the estimated backlog more than double to over $1.5 billion. In addition, as we look over the coming 10 years, we see an estimated $1.4 billion in building systems and components reaching the end or exceeding their useful lives. This, coupled with the $1.5 billion already in backlog, tells us we have a roughly $2.9 billion 10-year renewal need to address the building systems already in backlog and take care of items as they age out in the years to come. If our request is totally funded, we would see about $105 million worth of backlog, both HEPR and capital projects, taken off of our list should it be fully funded. And a quick note, the $82 million that was in the governor's 2024 capital budget recommendation funds about 40% of our requested amount. This slide shows how we would apply those funds should they be made available today, addressing 23 projects at our college university campuses. and this is in alphabetical order, we would work individual priorities based on funding levels that are made available. Turning to page 12, you'll find a snapshot of the major capital projects, beginning with priority number two, the Academic Excellence Renovation Project at St. Paul College. And that's why President Beasley here wants to make sure that stays there. And is also included in the governor's recommendation in late January. This project, along with the following three, Minnesota State University Mankato Armstrong Hall replacement, the Winona State University Center for Interdisciplinary Collaboration, Engagement, and Learning, or CECL building, and the Alexandria Technical Community College and Transportation Center, found on pages 12 to 13, received design funding in 2023 and are ready for construction funding this session. The next group of individual projects beginning, I want to note that priority 19, the Rochester Community and Technical College Heinz Center renovation, also received funding for design in 2023 with general fund cash. And that project is also ready, will also be ready for construction funding this legislative session. Priority 6, the Riverland Community College Student Services renovation. Through priority 11, the Riverland College Healthcare Construction, Student Services, and Classroom Renovation at our Hutchinson campus were all in our request in 2022 and 23, but were not funded. Project overviews are on pages 14 through 16 of the bonding book if you're interested in additional detail. Finally, program priorities 12 through 16, beginning with a request for renovation and modernization of instructional spaces at the Winona campus of Minnesota State College Southeast, through the request for library renovations at Normandale Community College, our new funding requests this session. Pre-designs are complete on each of these projects. The request for the Dakota County Technical College is for design this session and will ultimately see construction funding in the future. Projects at MSC Southeast, South Central College, Anoka Ramsey Community College, and Normandale Community College would fund design and renovation of existing facilities if they were fully funded this session. More details about these individual projects are on pages 17 through 19. We recognize that competition for state funding is keen and state resources are limited, but investment in higher education is critical to the success of our students and all of Minnesota, and with impacts deep into the future. We have seen a general but steady decline in capital investments in higher education, whether it's investment in Minnesota State by itself or Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota combined, as you see in the line, top line in blue. This decline is concerning as many of our facilities and their systems are reaching the end of their useful lives. Recall that we have over a $1.5 billion backlog in items, and as we look to the future, an estimated $1.4 billion in coming needs due in the next 10 years. We will work to slowly reverse this trend this session and long into the future. A couple of points before closing. First, please know that the funding from 23 have been put to use and is making a difference today. With more than 20 HEPR projects underway, making campuses warm, safe, and dry, the 2023 program and also included funding for 13 individual campus projects. Construction is getting underway at Minnesota State University Moorhead, the Weld Hall. Many members have been and eaten many meals in that Weld Hall facility. Chair Lee, I saw you smile. Denver Hills Community College, as well as Minneapolis College, acting on designs funded in prior bonding bills. Pine Technical and Community College will soon wrap up their design process and move on to construction as well. Design is underway for projects at the Vermilion campus of Minnesota North College, the Brainerd campus of Central Lakes College, and the East Grand Forks campus of Northland Community and Technical College, Lake Superior College in Duluth, and Metropolitan State University and their cybersecurity program will begin construction very shortly at the St. Paul location. And as highlighted earlier, designs for projects at St. Paul College, MSU Mankato, Winona State University, Alexandria Technical and Community College, and Rochester Community Technical College are well underway and will be ready for construction funding this legislative session. And then finally, a quick snapshot of our HEPR report outlining the status of HEPR funds and expenditures over the last year. you'll see the spending, the final funds from our 2020 bonding bill is nearing completion, and we're well underway doing the same with the funding that was made available in 2023, with 100% of those funds obligated against 20 projects that are currently in design or moving towards construction. And of that, 30% has been encumbered and spent. We expect that to increase exponentially as we get closer to the springtime and construction season. We thank you for your time and attention today, as well as the last 6 months traveling across the state of Minnesota. We provided you an overview of our $541.4 million capital request and the priorities overall for this legislative session. We provided some details on the development process that brought the priorities and projects to you, and our HEPR and projects prioritized within that program. We are grateful for past support of our college universities, but are concerned about investment trends and ask for focus on asset preservation needs of our existing campus buildings to serve Minnesotans today and well into the future. Chair Lee and committee, this concludes our formal presentation. We look forward to any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Members, any questions or comments? Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the presenter for all the help that we got during all the things we did, just the direction and the food and stuff like that. I just want to thank you publicly. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scraba. Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
No meatless lasagna.
So next on the agenda, we'll now move on to the last item for today. It's a presentation from Director Micah Intermill from MMB to discuss federal funding from the IIJA. Welcome, Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Do you have slides?
And so, correction, the director will be talking about IIJA, IRA, and then the CHIPS Act. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Lee, Vice Chair Ryer, Lee Erdahl, and members of the committee. My name is Micah Intermill, and I'm the state's director for state's enterprise director for federal funds implementation, housed at Minnesota Management and Budget. I appreciate the opportunity to join you today and provide an update with respect to how the state is responding to the massive opportunity represented in the three recently enacted federal investment bills, the IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS Act. This presentation will look and feel different from those you've just received, as it does not contain any asks. Instead, it's the beginning of a conversation requested by the chair to help provide the committee context on the volume of infrastructure investments taking part across the state, which are supported heavily by federal funds. My goal today is to provide education and develop a baseline consensus understanding of the state's approach. I'll be back at your next two committee meetings, along with colleagues from across the state enterprise, where we will provide additional detail both on the state's successes in receiving funds and progress in deriving results from them. And we'll share with you where it is that we see continued area of opportunity across the state. To accomplish that goal, I'll start by giving you a high-level introduction to the Federal Funds Implementation Unit, which is a new team created in the 2023 legislative session. I will then provide an overview of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, IIJA, the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, and the CHIPS and Science Act, or CHIPS. Third, we'll get a brief preview of the Minnesota projected awards to date. This will be at a very high level, but we'll preview the deeper conversation we'll have with area experts this coming Wednesday and next Monday. And finally, I'll share a first look at Minnesota's IIJA Opportunity Tracker, which is a new tool developed by my team and published just days ago. First, it's important to recognize the historical context around these massive generational investments the federal government is making. As you see at the left of this slide, the story arguably began in November of 2021 with the passage of the IIJA. The IRA and CHIPS Act followed suit in the summer of 2022, and the three bills became the basis for a great many activities across the state enterprise as agencies set to work almost immediately to seek and bring home available federal resources, just as they continue to today. As you'll recall, discussions were had in this committee and in others in the 2022 legislative session, providing information to the extent it was known on available programs and formula allocations, as well as estimated state matching needs. And in 2023, the legislature appropriated many of those matching dollars and provided enterprise-level coordination support through the funding of me and my office and other positions across the state enterprise. That brings me to a fuller discussion of the federal funds implementation team. Because this is a new function, and it feels important to help you understand who we are and what we're here to do and how we're approaching our work. As mentioned, I have the pleasure and honor of serving the state as its enterprise director for federal funds implementation. I come to this role having spent roughly the past 20 years in various roles in and around government, both in direct public service at the federal, state, and local levels, as well as in the private sector roles, providing support and assistance to professional staff and policymakers alike. Having served in state roles previously, I returned to this capacity in November of last year, drawn both by the challenge and opportunity of starting this team from scratch, as well as the multi-generational impact of the work that we are facilitating. As I sit here today, I'm even more excited about the opportunities ahead for Minnesota than I was the day I came back to the Capitol campus. I'm currently joined on the team by two others, one individual who serves as a state agency coordinator working with and between state agencies across the enterprise to bring alignment to our work, and another who serves as a data analyst and communications specialist working to bring together the vast and varied amounts of data related to the IIJ, IRA, and CHIPS, so that not only can we inform Minnesotans about opportunities, but better focus our work internally as an enterprise to maximize our efforts. We've also posted and will soon be interviewing for an external relations coordinator who will be responsible for interacting primarily with non-state entities, including tribal nations, local governments, nonprofit organizations, schools, and others, to ensure they are aware of and taking advantage of federal opportunities as well. The four of us are here to work across state agencies to ensure successful alignment and implementation of the federal investment bills. I've included a graphic at the right of this slide that helps illustrate how it is that we're doing that work. With a small team and a large charge, we're working smartly to first find gaps in implementation efforts, either within or between agencies and outside eligible entities. Once we find gaps, we then work to fill them either in direct service roles on project teams or by connecting individual experts who may be better positioned to solve for problems without our assistance. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, we're here to tell success stories so that individuals and organizations can not only see themselves in the opportunities available, but also understand how to access them should they be a fit. Finally, as we approach this work with the ultimate goal of supporting Minnesota's public infrastructure needs and climate goals by maximizing all available opportunities in all sectors, which is to say, we're focusing on Minnesota broadly, think lowercase m, not capital M, so that at the end of the day, when the story is written on the IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS Act, our state is at the top of the list in terms of, yes, the dollars received, but more importantly, the good work funded by those investments. Thank you for allowing me that the time to introduce who we are and how we're approaching the work, but now I'll turn to the meat of the investments themselves, with an overview of the IIJA, the IRA, and the CHIPS Act. These three pieces of federal legislation, collectively known as the investment bills, are massive and bring with them a generational opportunity for Minnesota. Beyond their sheer size, it's important to note that they work together in complementary ways to achieve various policy goals. As I mentioned earlier, the first bill to pass was the IIJA. This bill contains $1.2 trillion with a focus on traditional infrastructure, which is to say roads, bridges, pipes, ports, and so on, as well as transitioning our nation's energy systems to cleaner and renewable sources. The IRA overlaps significantly with the IIJA in the area of energy transition and also introduces funding opportunities specifically available to support decarbonization and other climate resilience and pollution reduction work. The CHIPS Act, while still providing a significant sum of resources, is the smallest of the three bills, and its focus is much narrower. It aims to increase American competitiveness by investing deeply in the development of the manufacturing sectors of tomorrow. I've included dollar amounts on this slide to reinforce the size of the opportunities that lie ahead for Minnesota. As I mentioned a few times already, these are truly generational investments. And as you know through your work on this committee, decisions made about when, where, and how much concrete to pour or steel to set are ones that our children and grandchildren will experience in their daily lives. What's unique about the IIJA, IRA, and CHIPS is their size. It can be difficult to immediately understand that a billion and a trillion are not just the next markers past a million. So for context, a million seconds is about 12 days. A billion seconds is half a lifetime, or a bit under 32 years. A trillion seconds is more than all of recorded history at just under 32,000 years. The point here is that there's a lot of opportunity in these federal investments, and Minnesota is well positioned to take every advantage of them that we can. Before we turn back to the dollars and cents, I did want to spend a brief moment touching on the differences between the investment bills and the major federal spending bills that immediately preceding them, the CARES Act and ARPA, also known as the Rescue Plan or Recovery Funds. The nature, goals, and funding mechanisms of each set of legislation is fundamentally different. And those differences are important when considering how decisions are made about dollars being spent. CARES and ARPA represented an emergency response to the public health pandemic and the public financial crisis it triggered. The primary goal was to get dollars out quickly to drive that response, and so then the mechanism used to distribute dollars was large block grant programs with broad spending authority. Awards were made to states and local governments, and the governing bodies of each unit was responsible for deciding how to use these dollars after they had been received. IRA, IIJ, and CHIPS are steering intentionally directed investments with the goal of effectuating the policy objectives I just discussed. The mechanisms used then are to fund individual projects through specific programs. And that means that the decision of how to use the dollars is being made when applications are going in, not when the dollars are being received. As the committee is considering its work of developing an infrastructure package and contemplating how federal investment opportunities may support the state's dollars, this slide represents an important distinction and difference of today's reality from what we experienced under prior federal funds. To the point of intentionally directed investments, this slide represents where and how the government is focusing its dollars under the IIJA. The vast majority, or just over three out of every four dollars of IIJA funding is for transportation projects. Over half of the funds represent a reauthorization of the FAST Act and support its emphasis on federal surface transportation infrastructure and safety. Those dollars are accompanied by additional transportation programming dollars in the areas of roads and bridges, rail, transit, airports and ports, and transportation safety. The IIJA also provides significant funding in traditional areas of broadband and water infrastructure, as well as money to support our environment through the stewardship of public lands. Finally, as mentioned, the legislation carries a secondary emphasis on climate and clean energy, with 10 cents of every dollar going to support investments in energy and the power grid, electric vehicle infrastructure, and climate resilience and adaptation. This is all very good news, as Minnesota has massive needs in these areas in all corners of the state. However, in general, these monies are not programmed to support the asset preservation needs or new construction of public buildings, which of course represents a major need in communities across Minnesota and is an emphasis of this committee. There are two other important points to consider when thinking about the grants available under the IIJA. First, roughly three quarters of grant funding made available is allocated based on formula calculations. These formulas are based on different factors depending on which funding area we're looking at, but the how much story on these funds has been written. The remaining quarter of IIJA grant funds are being dispersed through competitive award processes, and Minnesota is being aggressive in pursuing these competitive opportunities. We'll share more on our successes in a few slides. The second artifact of the IIJA grant ecosystem to keep in mind is that 75% of grant funds have been made available through the reauthorization of previous programs. Once planning for an infrastructure project begins, it is often years before ground is broken on a facility, road, or bridge. having faith in the reauthorization process is what allows us to have had shovel-ready projects that took advantage of IIJA funding early on. The remaining quarter of grant opportunities made available through new programs then represent work that is pushing boundaries, either by equipping more shovel-ready projects than would otherwise have been funded, or by providing funding for new areas such as the National Electric Vehicle Charging Network. Both segments of the pie, while unequal in size, are equally important to modernizing our state infrastructure. I'll turn back to our IIJA results to date in a moment, but first I wanted to touch briefly on federal funds opportunities under IRA and CHIPS. The graphic at left represents the funding mechanisms contained within the IRA. Whereas the majority of funding opportunities available under the IIJA are executed through grant agreements, the IRA is more complex and nuanced. The IRA contains three key mechanisms to distribute funds: grants, loans, and tax credits. Grant programs are capped at $110 billion, and we'll go deeper on those in a minute. And loan programs are capped at approximately $500 billion. The third set of funds, clean energy tax credits, are uncapped, meaning there is as much money available as there is demand to use them. Estimates of the value of those credits varies, ranging from $700 billion to $1.2 trillion. These credits are bigger than previous clean energy tax credits. They are broader than previous programs, and for the first time, they're available as direct payments to non-taxable entities, including states, local governments, tribal nations, nonprofits, schools, and others. And they are intended to immediately drive down the cost of switching from traditional fuel sources to renewable ones. The only catch with the credits is that they come after a project has been put into service, as opposed to a grant, which would be available to spend at the outset of a project. That's where the guaranteed loans come in to provide a means for bridge and gap financing of projects at low rates. Final details of the tax credit program are still being worked out, and non-tax entities of all stripes, including the state of Minnesota, are working together to inform the federal government on how best to finalize them. Turning back to grants for a moment, like the IIJA, the grants available under the IRA represent a whole-of-government approach, as they come from several different agencies representing various policy objectives with an emphasis on clean energy transition, conservation, climate resilience, and pollution reduction efforts. Notably, though, in a meeting late last year with the Department of Energy, they noted 70% of IRA grant opportunities were either decided or in the process of decision making. While we will continue to aggressively pursue grant opportunities like the Climate Pollution Reduction Grants or Solar for All program and others, tax credits and loans remain the largest opportunity to bring back federal funds to Minnesota under the IRA. That then brings us to the CHIPS Act, which, as the graphic at left suggests, brings a three-pronged approach focusing on driving economic security, national security, and future scientific innovation. Like the IRA, this legislation utilizes a mix of funding approaches, including manufacturing incentives, workforce development funds, tax credits for development and equipping of manufacturing facilities, and future authorizations of additional research and development funds. In the interest of time, and turning back to the IIJA, we'll move to a summary of projected funding for Minnesota to date. This will be, again, at a high level, where we're seeing the money flow. And as a reminder, agency experts will join the committee this Wednesday, February 21st, and next Monday, February 26th, to discuss the projects that are funded under specific programs within the categories that I'm about to share. We'll also touch on future opportunities under the IIJA for Minnesota. This chart and the associated graphic represent the projected funding picture for Minnesota under the IIJA. These figures are informed by information obtained on February 6th from an organization known as Federal Funds Information for States, or FFIS, and includes both the announced competitive awards as well as calculated formula allocations. MMB and other states rely on FFIS to provide a comprehensive database of these projected funds so that we can see and understand how our experience relates to each other. This service is invaluable, but it also comes with a caveat. Because of complexities of delivering capital programming over multiple years, some programs do not fully distribute the calculated formula amounts, meaning the dollars we ultimately receive will be fewer than the amounts shown on this slide. This is most prevalent in the transportation space. As a result, you'll hear MnDOT on Wednesday describe how they manage to a different number than shown here so that they can ensure they don't fall short of funds needed to complete a project. Other areas, such as water, have their own operational differences from the nationally reported state-specific numbers, and those will be explained by PFA as well. Caveats aside, when MMB first came to this committee 2 years ago to talk about the IIJA, all that was known was that Minnesota was set to receive a calculated formula allocation of $7.4 billion. Today, I'm extremely happy to report that while that number has not changed, it is joined by roughly $2.3 billion of competitive awards that would not have come but for the hard and high quality of work performed across agencies in all corners of the enterprise. As we sit here today, Minnesota has claimed $9.7 billion of IIJA monies. The fact that our mix of formula and competitive grant funding sits very near the 76-24 split shared on a previous slide should not be taken for granted. To the contrary, it's a testament to the fact that agencies have been doing the work they need to do to make sure Minnesota is not left behind. And if my team and I have done our jobs, we'll only see the share of competitive awards grow in the coming months and years. Finally, I am going to do a little dance here and pull up a different slide to illustrate how new this Minnesota Opportunity Tracker is. When I started in November, I met with various stakeholder groups and individuals. And in general, I heard two primary themes. First, it's hard to get eligible entities, whether local units of government, tribal nations, or others, to understand the opportunity ahead of them because of the federal funds fatigue that exists in the wake of ARPA and CARES, and because there's not a simple, easy clearinghouse of available opportunities for them to access. The second theme I heard is that the state of Michigan has a really cool tracker. I couldn't be prouder of my team, as they worked tirelessly over the past month to ensure Minnesota would have an opportunity tracker of its own to help our residents, businesses, local governments, and our partner tribal nations quickly and easily digest the current and upcoming IIJA opportunities. Folks can use this tracker to search by category, fiscal year, and soon entity type to learn more about the programs and funds available. I wish I could share it with you here. Due to technological limitations, I can't, but I encourage you all to navigate to the URL shown on the slide and share it widely with your staff, your constituents, and anyone else interested in finding out how Minnesotans can take advantage of the historic opportunities available under the IIJA. The last point that I'll make on the tracker is that this is a first iteration, or a V1, if you will. We plan to continue to enhance the quality of information and usability of the tool. And we also have plans to include data and information on additional awarded funds in the coming weeks. So keep your eye out for all of that. And with that, I will pause and stand for questions.
Thank you, Director, for that breakdown. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director, appreciate your presentation to us. Just wondering, you know, looking at the projected awards for Minnesota and looking over the list, and in view of what we just talked about before, is there any money that could be set aside for higher education?
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erdahl. The higher education institutions are available for a great many opportunities under the IIJA. I think, as I had alluded to in my prepared remarks, because of the nature of the program, or the nature of the IIJA, where there are specific programs to fund individual projects, the challenge facing the university and Minnesota state system, similar to the challenge facing the state of Minnesota as an entity, is that we need to match projects that we have to those individual programs. So as opposed to something like the like ARPA or the CARES Act, where we received a set of funds and were able to decide where and how to allocate those funds, it's the opposite, where we have a project and apply through that project to the federal government, and they make a decision on an award, in large part. So the short answer is there may be ability to fund some projects under IIJA or IRA dollars. In reality, it's a lot more complicated and complex. So it's a case-by-case basis.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned a match. What type of match has to be given for this?
Director.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Representative. So different programs come with different match requirements. As you all are aware, the Minnesota legislature appropriated significant matching dollars in the areas of transportation to the Department of Commerce for energy projects, to the Department of Employment and Economic Development for projects under the CHIPS Act. I hate to give you the answer again, it depends on which program we're talking about, but what I can tell you in general about MATCH is that the state has, between last year and the dollars that were appropriated last year, between what is contained in the governor's recommended bonding bill, we have what is needed for now. There are future needs in future years, for additional matching funds, and we'll have those amounts at that time. The other thing I'll say about state dollars encouraging federal dollars is that there may be other operational or programmatic needs that could be paired with some of the federal grant opportunities that aren't exactly match requirements, but could help entice the federal granting agencies when they're looking at a Minnesota award.
Representative Dahl.
No, thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this presentation. I just want to start out and note that, you know, you'd mentioned that you've been working with stakeholders on this, and I would appreciate or just maybe encourage you to engage with the people's elected representatives who might have a different perspective than stakeholders on certain things. That being said, our state has had been applying for federal grants, and particularly in the wastewater, drinking water areas, has looked at median household income. We are familiar through our work with the National Conference of State Legislators that other states look at different criteria for prioritizing, perhaps looking at census tract information to reach for environmental justice areas. In addition, with infrastructure, looking at green infrastructure, tree planting, et cetera, just instead of only the physical building a pipe. And so I just like your perceptions on that, because getting money into the state also is also influenced by what you do with it within the state, and that if we just keep doing the way we've been doing things, there will be winners and losers, as there have been. And I think the intent on particularly the Inflation Reduction Act is to try to deal with climate, and that means looking at green infrastructure, making it available, rather than just doing the same things we've always done.
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, to your first point, I absolutely agree that I am eager to meet with you and your colleagues at any time to talk about these issues in depth. To the broader point, I think that it's what I appreciate and am hoping not to lose sight of as I get deeper into the work, is that these dollars represent both a moment in time and the ability to take care of some backlog that exists, as well as, again, because of their size, the opportunity to do things differently. So I think your point is very well taken. In the 20 years of experience that I mentioned, I'm often one to challenge status quo. And folks often remind me that there's a reason that we have built up a process the way that we have, so there is a natural tension there. And I certainly defer to our experts at PFA who manage some of the programs that you mentioned. But I agree, and the team that I'm building and bringing on is really here to help with advance some of those thoughts around, can we be doing things differently, particularly because many of the systems that we are operating under today are have been built up on decisions that were made for good reasons in the past, but may have different, we may be living under different circumstances that just necessitates a different approach.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, and I look forward to having those conversations with you. I do have an additional question on the Department of Agriculture money. Does that go through you, or is that USDA direct to entities and individuals?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, short answer is it's a mix.
Members, any additional questions for the director before we move on? So, Director, to what extent can you talk about the governor's proposal and how many of those projects or line items have your office taken a look at to see if they could potentially fit in with federal funding or not?
Yeah, Chair Lee, I appreciate the question. And while I am not prepared to answer that question directly, Mary Ann Conboy from MMB is also here. And she can speak to some of the interaction between the governor's recommendation and federal funds.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed to answer the question.
Good afternoon, Shirley. I'm Mary Ann Conboy. I'm the Capital Budget Coordinator at Minnesota Management and Budget. Just there's a couple highlights in the governor's recommendations to, besides local matching opportunities, to take advantage of federal match opportunities. The highest one is at PFA, the state match for federal grants, the state revolving loan funds. That provides a match of $196 million in federal funds, which includes IIJA match, in addition to the normal EPA grants that they receive. MnDOT high priority bridges, there's $40 million in the governor's recommendation. It assumes a 20% match to leverage up to $160 million in federal funds. Including IIJA funds. In addition, the MnDOT Port Development Assistance Program, $3 million is in the governor's recommendation. The match is unknown, but those funds may also be used for IIJA match, is what's anticipated. And also ADMIN, the State Facility Renewable Energy and Storage Fund, $1.5 million is in the governor's recommendation for a 30% federal tax credit on state investment. Of $450,000 anticipated for that. And that's on top of the normal non-IIJA or non-IRA grant funds, such as at Bowser, Met Council, Military Affairs, and Veterans Affairs that are more like typical. The ones that I highlighted above are IIJA or IRA.
Sounds good, thank you. And then, Director, maybe just for your colleagues that will be joining us, I know that in our meetings together, I brought up funding. I saw that the Go Line extension, BRT, and then recently the Duluth Airport. I think it will be helpful for us as these different local projects come before us if you could let us know if any of them have had federal funding or have received funding. I think this goes to your point around telling the story. And so it will be helpful for us if you could tell us which local projects that are coming before us have received funding or, you know, are in line to get federal funding that may need some state funding. And so we could have the clear picture of what we need to do this session going forward.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
All right, members, so before we end, I want us to adopt the meeting minutes for last week, February 14th. Vice Chair Ryer, can I have a motion to adopt the minutes?
Chair Lee, I move approval of the minutes for February 14th, 2024.
Vice Chair Ryer moves approval of the minutes for February 14th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails that the minutes are adopted. Members, just a roadmap for the next two hearings. As has been mentioned, we will be hearing more on federal infrastructure dollars coming to our state. This coming Wednesday will be focused on transportation-related funding. And MnDOT will be here to provide information on airports, EV, buses and ferries, passenger and freight rail, public transportation, road, bridges, and major projects, and safety. Seeing no other business before us, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.